I grew up on Long Island, New York, just outside of New York City on the South Shore. So I grew up on the beach, not the mountains. And I was getting an English degree down at a little Mount St. Mary's College in Emmitsburg, Maryland, about an hour outside of D.C. And I got a job loading chairlifts in a little ski area in the evenings for a little extra cash, and they gave me free skiing and almost blew that last semester. But I did manage to graduate, and I decided when I did, I was going to take a little time, take 1 year off before getting real about life. And so I moved up to Vermont and to go skiing for a year and broke my leg. And then I said, well, that year didn't count. So then I moved to Utah, and there's the only picture I could find, Kat, my wife, who I met at Alta, dug that out. So that was a few years back. And the year I got there, and I was there for a few years, bartending, waiting tables, that lodge you see behind there was hit by an avalanche. Several other lodges were. Some cars were hit, thrown over across into the main ski area. And I started doing some backcountry skiing, and we used to post hole up Lake Mount Superior back there behind you. The equipment really wasn't very good then. And I just got trying not to get killed. I was trying to learn as what I could about avalanches. Then I went to classes that I could find, Jackson Hole and such. And then Bill Harrison and a team of scientists came out from the Cold Regions Lab in New Hampshire. And they were studying snow, and I was interested in it. So I started just going out there and seeing what they were doing. So I gave up a little skiing, and I was my instrumentation talents were a shovel, which is still a major talent to have in snow research. And so I worked with them a bit, and then Bill asked me if I wanted to work with Kirill the next season. So I went back to New Hampshire for a little bit and learned a little bit about what they wanted to do. And then I went up, and this is out of Albion Basin, people know Alta, and we had a little site, a little trailer when I went up there, and I broke some instruments and did some other things. And I got a little bird on my finger there, if you notice. I was apparently communing with wildlife, and sure should have been doing some instrumentation. But, yeah, so I was there, and then Bill said, you know, if you really want to study snow, you ought to go back to school. And I said, you know, I was mid-20s or more, you know. I mean, my Lord, I said, Bill, you know how old I'm going to be if I go back and do that? And he just looked at me, and he said, how old are you going to be if you don't? And it was like such a great line. So he said, what you need to do is you need to go study snow. And the place to do it is Montana State University. And the man to do it is Bob Brown. And I bet you a number of people in the audience still remember Bob. He was a prof here for quite a while. He was dean of the graduate school. Anyway, so I came up and I don't want to belabor all this early stuff. But I worked with Bob. And I can't tell the story of my progression without talking about the progression of snow research at MSU. And John Montaigne and Charles Bradley began research here in the Earth Sciences Department in about 1960. And these guys were World War II vets who were in the 10th Mountain Division. And they brought their skills and their science background to MSU and got that started. And in fact, when I came up to talk to Bob, they put together my English degree, right? And I said, oh, I'll go to grad school. And he went, yeah, right. And so they put together a second program for me that was a mishmash of engineering mechanics and earth sciences. And they put it under the title of geophysics. And so I got that as a second degree. And John Montaigne was actually my advisor for my bachelor's and then Bob for my graduate work. And the Earth Science Department still has a snow science program. You get an undergraduate degree in snow science at MSU. And then in about 1972, Charles Bradley went over and he talked to Bob Brown and Ted Lang. And Bob was an aerospace engineer. He worked for Lockheed and he worked on the Saturn V rocket. And Ted Lang worked for JPL. So they were aerospace people. And Ted, Bob is retired, of course, but Ted is still teaching. He's not doing research anymore, but he is still teaching. And then the next generation, I guess, Jimmy Dent there in the middle, he was here when I arrived. He's since retired, too. He retired pretty early. And then Dan Miller, who you've just met. And Rob Larson here, he's kind of our MacGyver. He makes all the equipment kind of work and builds it, and he keeps things running. And our newest associate here is Kevin Hammonds. He just came here from Dartmouth. He's been here almost a year now. So within a few month or so, he'll be a year. And so Kevin's our new guy, going to keep this whole process going. So hopefully this whole moves on beyond those of us who are still here, and I'm not here for that long, I guess. And I wanted to show this sign. This is Northwest Passage as you leave the area. This is kind of an old sign. It was old then, apparently. But it says, beyond this extreme avalanche hazard, closed to skiing. What does that say? Oh, violators lose their pass, rescued by the sheriff's department, and survivors will be paid for the expense of rescuing them, which I think was a good plan, right? Anyway, that's open. So our research site, we headed north out of here. So we used to go up in the morning with the patrol on control morning and take that old rope tow up there, if people remember that, and go up and hike out. And that's my avalanche dog, Black Bart of the Bridgers. And he was a good dog. He was the second avalanche dog in the area. So anyway, I was here and sort of leaving the area kind of, I had to leave the area again. And I took a job when I graduated. And I moved to Michigan Tech University, which is there in Houghton, on the Keweenaw Peninsula, and they get a lot of snow. Okay, it's that lake effect snow, most snow east of the Rockies, and that's a kind of a tourist stop there on the left. That's the snow thermometer, and that's the maximum snowfall they've gotten there. So they just get this, it snows every day. It just doesn't stop snowing for 3 months. It's really remarkable. It's good light snow and stuff, and but, you know, I wasn't really home, and what happened is Bob Brown became the dean of the graduate school, and a position opened up, so I came back, okay? And almost as soon as I did, I went back out to the area that we had been, that I had done a lot of graduate work up on the ridge, and I've got to mention, at the time, we used to go over to Butte and buy explosives. And we'd leave the area, and we had a backpack full of explosives in our own, and nobody else was allowed to leave the area at that point. So it made forecasting for two people easy. So we had a backpack full of explosives. But anyway, we did see this site that we could get to go off almost any time. So if I can get this to play. Dan talked about the avalanche site, and we built it. I wanted to go back. I wanted to play in the mountains. So we went out and looked at this site that I knew we could get. We called it Revolving Door. And we had actually put a bomb tram across the top, which I think the first one in North America. And so we could set off avalanches pretty much any time there was a decent snow. Just very, very dependable. So we were walking down and looking across at the slope in the summer, and there's this big rock. And so we looked at it and said, you know, I bet we could bolt in behind there. And you know, it's like a bunch of Boy Scouts, but we built this, bolted ourselves in and put this together, and we had the bomb tram set up above, and then when it snowed next time, we went up there to see what had happened, and we set off the slide, and yeah, it worked pretty well, and he should have been in a little quicker than that, but we were just learning, and anyway, and so it kind of goes black when you first get there, and then it's sort of the light comes back, and we got a little better at this. That was the early on, and so it was really fun. We started getting some data. We had a lot of different instrumentation things we tried out, and we were always trying to look at the structure of the snow before, after, and during. And so that's kind of, I've kind of always looked at the microstructural side of things. So here's another shot of that, and if you look up that orange post there, we had taken, this is a little later on, Dan Miller was involved at this point, and we put 4x4s in to hold the fence. We wanted to push it, there's a kind of a double fall line, so we wanted to push the snow back towards the shed, so we got a better shot. 4x4 didn't do much. And, you know, this isn't a very big avalanche, but it's big enough, and that's the reason I wanted to show this a little bit, is kind of what's going on, and it runs a ways. It sort of trashed our fence. That part of it didn't work very well. But notice how it didn't fill in the back anymore. We took care of that problem. And it was actually, they're fairly sizable slides, so they were kind of fun. But we were pretty careful about it. We knew what we were doing. The first time we did it, we clipped in and shit. But, excuse me. And then, so that led to a bit of notoriety, you know. And so this, I pulled this out when I knew I was doing this talk, and I was supposed to give my life history in snow, you know. So this is Good Morning America, right? So I got a call and said, hey, could you come out like tomorrow and be on Good Morning America? And I went, well, I guess, you know. And so I did, and I got snowed in. It took me 2 days to get there from a snowstorm, but I did. So anyway, I found this tape, and the tape was not very good. It was an old VHS that I hadn't seen since then, and someone had recorded over probably Marianne Brown because it had a PBS documentary on there doing something with quilts or something, and this was filmed over it, you know. It was somewhere in the middle, and I brought it over to Billy over in Film and TV, and he turned it into a video that I could clip a little piece out of. So I'll show you that. And Dan just saw it and said I looked older, but...
And then sitting still while the snow covers him. His story is featured in the current issue of National Geographic Adventure magazine, and Ed Adams is joining us this morning. It's nice to have you here.
Well, nice to be here.
I say you get covered, but you've built a shed in the middle of an area where there are avalanches, and then you set them off and watch them, right?
Yeah, we built a little shed. We're bunkered behind a rock, and we initiate the avalanche explosion with a bomb cable that we have across the top, and we sling an explosive out. And so the basic scenario, we have a bunch of usually grad students, other colleagues who are on the side watching us to be sure things are safe inside the shed, and then we'll set off a slide.
But you don't do that for fun. I mean, you are doing that to study them, and I'm curious what you're learning.
Well, we're trying to understand basically the structure of snow. There's three phases as I look at it. We've got the snow on the mountain as it's sitting there, and it's constantly undergoing all sorts of changes. We're trying to understand this layer cake of structure, and when is it safe to be there, and what will it take to initiate an avalanche? The second phase of that is, once the avalanche starts moving, what's happening dynamically inside there? Can we see inside that avalanche? And that's one of the reasons we decided to bunker inside this shed, to put our instruments out there, to look through a little window and see if we could just stick our hand out and feel that in a safe environment. And then after that, it comes to a roaring stop. And as it does, it sets up like a block of concrete. If you've ever seen a rotary snowplow dumping snow on the side of the road, go jump on it a few minutes later. It sets up like a brick. So we're trying to understand those three parts. So the moving part is the part that you'll see here.
Okay, so just describing a little bit about a couple of types of avalanches, or three types actually. A loose snow avalanche, kind of the typical cartoon avalanche, starts at a point, kind of granular flow, and flows down. We don't look at those too much. Well, I haven't been. Another, our wet slide, that one on the left is the Bridger from about 2012, probably a couple of years ago, or a few years ago, where had a big wet slide event. This one in the middle is a Goat Creek up by Glacier, and that took out that bridge at least once. And the one right, I think, is in Davos, Switzerland. But anyway, those are kind of a couple of types of avalanche. The slab avalanche is kind of the one I'm sort of going to work with a little bit, and mostly just talk about the metamorphism associated with it. But it's like you can see the top crown there, and that's kind of a cohesive block of snow that tends to break away. So I'll try to give a little... went to YouTube, and let's see if we can make this work. Kind of give an idea. So if you look, that thing is breaking in a big slabs of snow, and it's not where the skier is necessarily. It's kind of off to the side, and it's propagating somehow. Now, this is great. This guy is jumping off. Things look good, right? Things are looking fine for this young gentleman, I presume. And... right about there, he probably thinks things are changing for him, you know. So I got a few more of these. So and really what I want to look at this is the way that there's a cohesive slab on top, obviously where the name comes through. And here's another. This is kind of a beauty. And obviously there's a mistake made here, at least one. And there's three people out there where they really shouldn't be all out there at the same time. But probably, I guess, if you have a helicopter filming, you'll probably do some sillier things. But anyway, I understand all of these people survived, and I will skip that. Okay, so this is a slab. Carl Berkland, I believe, gave me this a few years ago. I think it's a really good slide to illustrate what we want to do here. So the slab avalanche, you can see just like in that previous picture, But that slid on this little, it's called a surface or a layer, which I'll describe in a little bit, but it's a weak layer in between two relatively stiff areas. And that layer had been buried for about 6 weeks when that slide went off. These are called persistent weak layers. And surface hoar is a problem for avalanches in general, in this area in particular. And then I want to show one more slide in here that's kind of about me and continues on, but it segues to what I want to.
Ed Adams has been tracking deadly slides in the U.S. for over 30 years.
Data clock triggered, yes! Hi!
In his younger, wilder days, he made headlines for putting his instruments and himself right in the line of fire.
People thought we were a little crazier than we were.
Today, he's burying himself in the finer, microscopic details of avalanche research.
So, I'm going to talk then about the microstructure, and that's kind of where most of my emphasis has been. So it's not just important for avalanches. It controls almost everything that has to do with snow. So we're just finishing up a project right now down in the park looking at the influence on the snow of tires versus tracks. And a number of years ago, we did some work for landing aircraft in Antarctica. We did that down in West Yellowstone at the airport there, and we processed snow and tried to see what we could do. And it was cold. It was plenty cold in West Yellowstone to simulate Antarctica. But microstructure is really important to pretty much every aspect of snow. Every aspect. How much the sun reflects, how much heat is conducted through it, what its physical strength is. Almost every single property is somehow connected to the microstructure. And here's so obviously falls from the sky, and it's a hexagonal crystal, and it's got six sides, and these secondary features, these dendritic structures, they grow. So the snow is always, the ice always is a hexagonal crystal, and these beautiful crystal shapes develop as they fall through the atmosphere. And depending on the temperature and the level of supersaturation, so the secondary features, the dendritic stuff, has to do with the level of supersaturation. This one's a little wetter. This one was at a probably lower supersaturation. There was no arms. Those are needles that form. This is a capped column. Probably that crystal probably fell through the atmosphere. These are not my pictures. I got these off of did a show with David Suzuki, The Nature of Things, on Canadian Broadcasting, and they had this on there, so I stole it, okay? So, but I was in it, so I figured I wasn't really stealing it. So that probably fell through a different environment. You got this capped column. And the structure is pretty interesting. It has to do with the temperature changes from left to right on that figure, and it goes from basically plates and needles or columns to plates to needles, and it's really not well understood why there is that transition. The secondary features, as you go on the vertical axis, give us those dendritic structures and stuff. So we get a wide variety of crystals from the axis. So no two crystals are ever alike. That's true in the sense that no two leaves are alike, and so they're never going to be exactly the same, but there are basic patterns. But that snow, once it lands on the ground, almost immediately begins to metamorphose. It starts to change shape. Snow is, I have described it as a shapeshifter. It just will not stay where you want it. It's a material that's constantly changing shape. It's changing its structure. And I'm not even talking about when it melts. I'm only dealing with the dry stuff. So anyway, what controls all that is basically the energy balance. It's completely determined by atmospheric conditions. So snow is a pretty good conductor, a pretty good insulator in general. It's got a lot of air in it. So we have conduction from the ground because it's pretty well insulated by the snow. So we've got conduction from the ground upward generally. We have solar radiation will come in. Some's reflected, some's absorbed. And snow is somewhat transparent because ice is basically transparent in the visible. We have long wave radiation, which exchanges with the sky, exchanges with its surroundings. And then we have convective, which has to do with the wind and stuff blowing over it. And we also have phase change as the ice changes phase. So So we did a little work. This I brought back from Michigan Tech. I did some work. They were doing work with the military on, they called them tactical decision aids. And what they were, they built a vehicle out of its thermal properties. So they'd make the tire, they'd give it its thermal property, they'd give the turret its thermal property, and they'd build out of plates, they'd build an elements of structure. Well, I was asked to come and put in snow as a background. They just wanted a flat background, so that was pretty straightforward. So we did that. And then I threw away the tank, and I turned the trees into a plate, and I turned the rocks into a plate, and I turned the snow. I gave all different natural materials thermal properties and then tried to model it that way. So this is with the Bozeman Pass, actually. We did a project with the highway department trying to get the temperature of the pavement. And a lot of this had to do with I wanted to see if we could model the surface conditions for snow. And the way this works is fairly straightforward. If you think about a plate and another plate, they're going to see each other depending how they're tilted. They're going to relate to each other. So that's a radiation exchange. So it'll be long wave, short wave. And they're going to bounce around. And then underneath those, it's got conditions for conduction and stuff. So we have depth. But that's kind of the surface thing. And each one of those will see another plate. And then each one of those plates, you can tell it to have however many rays you want. So each plate now is shooting out a whole bunch of rays, seeing a bunch of other plates. Those other plates are all talking to all the other plates, and you get this thermal map of the thing. And this was, like I say, developed by the military for vehicles, and we just took it and turned it into something we could use for terrain. So just a quick example of kind of what that looks like. This is a south-facing slope. The sun's at my back, and you're going to look at it. You can see these are trees up front, and these are rocks up. And you can see as it starts to heat up, you can see the shadow. So that's a temperature change, a result of the shadowing. But the thing to notice, too, is there's a lot of variation in the surface of the snow here, the surface of the snow temperature. So we got that map, and we've used that. This is a site down at the Yellowstone Club where we've done quite a bit of work. And so anyway, that's kind of something we're doing to try to give us the upper boundary condition. If we want to look at what happens to snow, it's controlled by all these atmospheric things. We need a way to input that. So this was one way we get at least the temperature input. And so a lot of the work, like I said, this is again at the club, and that's Dan up there, and we were... just at the natural environment, it's a great place to do snow research. Montana's obviously just perfect for it. We've got the universities here. We have labs. We got everything. But we have that natural environment that we never want to lose track of. And the snow is a whole bunch of kind of a layer cake, like I said. And this, the reason I kept this one in, when I got here, I was doing my undergraduate degree. I did a lab test, and that was on an old chart recorder, and I just stained the snow, and you can sort of see the layering. And so that's how we sample in the field. We measure density, temperature, and off on the left, that's a thin plate with a light behind it. You can kind of pick up some of the layering. So snow is a highly stratified material out in the natural environment. And let's see if this works.
It's a crisp, clear day at Montana State University. But inside this building, a winter storm is blowing.
We built this lab so we control the temperature of the sky, the intensity of the solar radiation, the humidity. We'll change one and see if it changes something over here. Change this, what does it do?
The Sub-Zero Lab is a precisely controlled cold research environment where researchers can reconstruct one of nature's deadliest forces, an avalanche.
Okay, so now that we've sort of covered the avalanching part of things, moving into the microstructure, I'm going to talk about a few different types. In a general sense, there's equi-temperature metamorphism, where things tend to rounden and strengthen, and there's temperature gradient effects, which things tend to become more faceted and tend to develop a weaker microstructural weaker structure. So this is a picture. You can kind of see here the... different grains. These are the necks, so these would be probably the original crystal, and you can see the bonds in between there. And what happens there, the primary driving process for this type of growth is there's a vapor pressure over a surface. Any ice surface has a vapor pressure over the top. And the radius of curvature, so how sharp of a bend I have in there, influences that rate. Think about stretching a balloon, stretching your knuckle, and there's a higher, if it was ice, there'd be a higher vapor pressure over my knuckle than there would be on the flat part of my knuckle, and then if I make that concave, less again. So what happens is we get a vapor motion from the concave towards the convex part, and we tend to build the bonds between. So this is a strengthening process, and it's called sintering. And the sintering process is well known in metallurgy, ceramics, that sort of thing. So it's very similar process. What is snow? How would you describe snow? And invariably, people will say, and if I asked you, someone will not say it, so I wouldn't do it. But it's white and it's cold, right? But from a mechanics standpoint, a material standpoint, snow is a very hot element because it's very close to its temperature of phase change. So you think about a ceramic or a metal. If I want to sinter a ceramic, I just crank that temperature way up and I get grains to bond together, right? We're very close to that in a natural environment, and that's one of the problems we have with trying to understand it. We're right at that boundary, so the snow will tend to change very, very quickly, so it's actually a warm material. The other thing that I guess I'll say now, too, is we also say it's white, but in the thermal infrared, snow is almost a black body, so at some level, snow is hot and black, so just take that home, okay? Here's the sintering process we took in the lab, and you can see, just to get an idea, that grain in between there, as we put these together, you can see that they're growing. So that's the sintering process that's going on. So this is strengthening. We're building bonds between grains. Now, if we take that and we turn that into a full structure, this is a scanning electron microscope picture. It's really nice because it's not transparent. It just sees the surface, so it does a really nice job of looking at this structure. And so this would be the type of snow that you'd probably see in that slab avalanche that I looked at where it was busted up. It's well bonded together. It's strong. It's the kind of stuff you would see probably in the ski area on snow roads. Strong bonded snow. Okay, and we did also see that it tends to fracture along those grain boundaries, because that's presumably the weak spot. And a big influence on snow in general, avalanches in particular, is wind. So if you look at moving from right to left, the wind is blowing across that field, and that's a big cornice at the end that's growing up there. But the part I want to talk about is when that snow blows over that, it's saltating on the windward side. Those grains are all fracturing. They're getting a lot of fracture. Think about breaking a bunch of glass, and there's all sharp angles. Those sharp angles are very high vapor pressure. So I take that, I throw it. They're very small grains because they've been beat up a bunch. It packs very densely, and I throw that together, and they bond very rapidly. Just like that picture I showed, the two little grains. Only multiply that by however many millions, right? And that builds a slab. So wind builds these slab avalanches, a big player in that game anyway, where they bond together. We have this now strong layer, and there's going to have to be some weak layer under it, and we'll get to that soon, okay? So this is a kind of a different one, and it's a spicule growth. So this I took, and we ground up some older snow. It was very well-rounded. And we just beat it up big time, and we then threw it on a microscope and watched it sinter. Well, no one ever really had seen this before, so it was kind of fun. But it happens in other materials. It's called their spicules is what the name I found out after we published a paper on it. But these needles grow out, and it's part of the bonding process. And I have not seen that often, but I have talked to other people who have seen it. I think it happens very early in the process. Like I say, we beat this up and then right away tried to get it on the microscope and have a look at it. So I think that happens then, and it's probably a player in the game. And what's kind of interesting, I think that there's so much, it's so super saturated in this environment that on the left there you can see the rounded grains are sintering, sort of like the little video I showed. But we're also getting these other crystals growing, which is a kinetic growth form, which is a very rapid growth. So both things are going on, and I think that's due to the fact that it's just such high energy. We probably put some thermal energy into it, beating it up, and then we packed it together and we threw it in the microscope real quick, and I think that's part of what's going on there. And this is one I just read really briefly. They're called Grain Boundary Ridge, and we found these with the SEM, very high magnification. And I don't know what to do with them exactly, except they have been seen by other people. And after we published something on this, someone else in California took it, and they sublimated everything away. And there's been some work done on the ice in the Antarctic, too, where they found this, these little fibers. And it's a mixture of ice and probably contaminants in the snow. And what happens is if you think about pulling this together with surface tension, you've got a pressure gradient from the center of the grain where those long arrows are moving towards the outside. That pushes it, and it drives the mass up here. And it's called grain boundary diffusion, and it's pushing mass up to that boundary. And presumably with that, probably is pushing up some of the contaminants. So when these people they sort of followed this paper up and they sublimated everything else away and they were left with this little fibrous structure around it. It was kind of interesting. So, but I want to move along here. And temperature gradient metamorphism, DEPFOR, a lot of people probably heard of it. It's basically what happens is snow is a good insulator. As I said, the ground is relatively warm. And when we have a cold snap, what we'll have is a very large temperature difference from the top of the snow to the ground, which may have 30 centimeters of snow. It's probably near 0 degrees C. So you'll have this mass flux, and thermal energy always goes from high to low. So this goes from hot to cold. It always flows in that direction. So it's going to be driving up. Well, when it does that, it's trying to move thermal energy across, and it ends up developing a weak structure. I'll show a couple of pictures of that in a minute. And here's so if you take a look at this now, this is a pore space, and I should have a pointer. I have one in my pack there, I think, but if I go to the left there, you can see the ice along the side, and out here you can see there's ice along the side. Well, ice is the conductor here, right? Ice is the best conductor we have. So the thermal energy all wants to move through that pathway. But the other thing that happens is it's hot here and cold there. This thermal energy is moving this way, but it gets to the top of that rounded grain. It wants to do something. It wants to help because the ground and the surface energy are trying to become the same temperature. The ground is going, hey, I can help. We can come to equilibrium if we just work, okay? So what happens is this thermal energy, if you think about it getting up to that part, it wants to go across. Well, it doesn't have a good mechanism because the conductivity in air is not very good. The conductivity in ice is very good. But what it does have on its side is it can sublimate. It can go from a solid to a vapor. When it does that, it's going to take energy from one to the other, and it doesn't actually change. But anyway, it moves across, and it condenses onto the top and deposits, and it transfers thermal energy by moving mass. So when it does that, if I get this started again, It gives up its own life in order to send the energy up to the top. So the rounded grains disappear, and these faceted grains start to grow. These are weak. Faceted grains tend to be very weak. So we end up with DEPFOR, okay? And it's at the bottom of the snow pit. If you've been out in the field and you reach in, it's often called sugar snow because once you grab it and break it, it's very fragile. It's brittle, and it just flows like sugar in your hand. So that's DEPFOR. And so these are a couple of crystals. These are kind of fun to grow. I brought back some lake ice from the dry valleys in Antarctica, and I had these great big ice crystals, single crystals of ice. And they were in the lab, you know, and I had them back because they were kind of cool, and we were figuring out what to do with them. And had an idea that maybe we could try just see what happens with crystals. So we put one where we had the C-axis, so that would be perpendicular to the hexagonal plane. Well, I got a picture up there on the top, the basal plane there, and then the side plane. So by gluing these onto the top here, putting a temperature gradient across it, filled this with snow. We just supplied mass, and these picked up the orientation of the parent crystal. So these, you don't see them quite this perfect generally in the field, but they just perfect. You know, so that worked. And this now, if we look at what's going on, if you can kind of see what's happening, like I said, the snow is doing everything it can to try to take the ground temperature and match it to the air temperature. It wants those to be the same. What's the best way to do that? I can move heat as fast as I can. So it starts to reorganize. And when it reorganizes, what it does is it builds these chains of ice, and then in between the ice, obviously, there's going to be channels. Okay? And so it kind of builds that structure. And if I pull out a little piece of that, you can see those chains starting to build. So it's going from warm to cold. Well, conduction straight away, no curves, straight through those two ice paths is a very efficient way to go. So it starts trying to change its structure to accommodate this. It's, you know, it's entropy reproduction, is sort of, it's the second law of thermodynamics. So Joe left. Oh, I got one. So anyway, we got that thermal energy trying to transfer. And if we run that over a period of time, so this is just over the course of about a month, you can see the change here. And we matched up, and so these paths on the left now are just following the ice. The ice is black, and so just following these paths, you can see the change in the ice network going from fairly anisotropic, fairly isotropic things are basically the same in all directions, to vertical. So then the thermal conductivity goes way up in this direction, and transverse, it tends to go way down. So these chains, there we go. These chains of ice, so that start out round, and just sort of watch in the middle there, and the ice is reorganizing. It's trying to move thermal energy, and it's saying, how do I do this? Well, it's trying to give it better pathways. And if you look at it, and they don't just go vertical with this. What they're going to look is for the highest gradient. So they might be a little bit off to the side, left or right, generally vertical, but off the right, which allows them to build transverse as well as vertical, and they build these columns. So that goes on. Okay, so one more thing. And this is all happening as we're walking around. This is all happening right now. You know, it's going on this very minute. These things are going on. So these are just some, you don't tend to see these in the field because they're very, very fragile. So these were in the lab, pulled them out, little tweezers, and are very careful trying to collect them. But it's full of these things. And this is a thermal image, so the numbers aren't very good for what it's calculating. But the blue is basically the air, and the red and greens are basically the ice. And you can see just kind of visually, it's hot to cold. It's going in the right direction. And I just like the way it kind of feel that flow. It just looks like a thermal energy flow. And it's going along those pathways that it's now established. And I think, although we don't know this yet, I think that this is going to come to a point where it's going to optimize the, if we held all the conditions perfect, it would come to some optimum spacing of both the ice and the pores that would allow buoyancy and actually natural convection to start to take place. But don't know that. But okay, so we've done that, and I'm still on schedule. And let's look at the surface next. Okay, so so we have the bottom, the top, we know how to make it strong. So we can make our slab. But we need some sliding surface, and we need some sort of a weak layer. So we're going to take a look at that. And the first one here is surface hoar. And surface hoar is just frozen dew, not very complicated. But snow is essentially a black body. So on a cold, clear night, the sky is very, very cold. The snow is relatively warm relative to that, and the black body radiation is going to shoot all that energy out to the sky, cooling the surface temperature, bringing the temperature of the surface below the, so that the air above it is now supersaturated. So it may not have been earlier, but as I cool that surface, I get deposition, so it builds up surface hoar, which was those pictures that I showed you of that slide that Carl Berkland had given me. That's surface hoar, and it's very dangerous. Here's another slide. This is just looking at that thermal modeling, and this is now a north-facing slope. And if you, so the, again, the sun is behind us. Is that showing up okay? And you can see where the shadows are, but look at where the trees are below and stuff. The white stuff just means it's saturated beyond the temperatures I wanted to see. So it's warmer because there's radiation exchange from the trees back to the snow, so it's keeping it warmer. The sun is heating up those trees. Those trees are then radiating through the long wave back into the snow and keeping that a little warmer. But beyond the temperature, we can then, once we know the temperature, if we know the relative humidity, we can calculate whether or not there should be deposition onto the snow surface. So now we've got this situation, this frozen dew condition, but it depends very much on the temperature. So what's interesting about this is if you look near the trees and stuff, where there's a lot of, it's not much deposition. So this is a mass flux. So think about this as that vapor becoming a solid on the top of the snow. But it's real spotty. And this is really important because in avalanches, sometimes I say it's don't be the third person because they call it a sweet spot. There's a weak spot. So if you think about this big slab underlain, say, by a surface hoar layer, they call them ultra weak zones. No one's ever really found one because then you're kind of in trouble, right? I guess a lot of people have found them, but they didn't want to. But it's a weak zone. What happens is you hit that, and then that fracture will then propagate underneath the whole thing, and you have a failure. Okay, so people are really interested in trying to see if there any way we could ascertain where that weak layer is. So we went in the lab and we grew some. Now this was a cup that was in a much larger box. Sat it in there. We took it out so we could remove it. Brett Stanton did most of this work, and that's a little nail in there just so you could mark it. And so we'd sit in there for a while, pull it out, and then this is a CT scanner, which we have in the Sub-Zero lab, and we can now take that and we can look at this in situ, because generally when we grab ice crystals, we grab a handful of them, we throw them on a little grid, we look at them and take a picture. They're all disaggregate. But that's not what we care about, right? We care about how they're bonded to the rest of that snow. So we got a CT scanner. We take that and we put it in there. Before I do that, this is a lab. We have a big box of snow. We fill our little cup, and it's in on the same surface with the rest of the snow, and let it sit there. And then we turn the ceiling on. I don't know if you caught in the little video that with the ceiling, this particular lab, we can control the ceiling temperature independently from the room temperature. We can hit it with a metal halide lamp, which does a pretty good job of simulating solar radiation. And we can then, we have a little contraption, we can put just a little bit of vapor over the near surface and blow it across. You need a little bit of wind in order for these things to grow effectively and blow across the surface and grow surface ore. So we do this in the lab, pull that sample out and scan it. So I was showing you earlier that on this same graph, we have needles growing here and different things growing at different places. So we ran a couple, Brad mostly, I should say, ran these tests. And so here's a result of that one. So like I said, this is a CT scan. So this is the initial condition. This is the rounded snow that we've just let, it's old, been sintered, it's gone through the whole process of first part of the talk. And so this is our structure. Now we take it, we put it in the cold room, we turn the ceiling to minus 50, we have the room running at minus 10, whatever, and we blow a little bit of moisture in there. And lo and behold, a few hours later, we get this structure forming. Now, this is the deposition. This is coming from the atmosphere onto the snow. So this is a growth onto. The other things we've been looking at have been the change of the structure within. So this structure is now forming a few hours later. And a few hours after that, these crystals continue to grow. So this is kind of that process that we grew at about a minus 5, okay? And the reason, these just, the spin makes the three-dimensional stuff a lot easier to see. If they're stagnant, they're static, they're harder to look at. And these are just some of the optical pictures of the same thing, these needle-like structures. And then we changed the temperature and ran it at about minus 15, minus 13, I guess. And this is just the final one because we started out with rounded snow. And you get a totally different structure. We change the temperature. Other conditions were all the same. We changed temperature, and we got this new structure. Now, what's going to happen, too, the snow, since it, as it deposits onto the turf, a number of things are going on, because there's a certain crystal type that wants to grow at a particular temperature. There's also a, at that temperature, there's going to be a certain orientation that's preferred. So as these grow, if there are other competing ones, and this particular crystal had that axis in the more perfect condition, it tends to crowd out the other ones. You see this in lake ice and stuff as well, where the fastest growing crystals will crowd out all the others, and you'll get these ice will turn from, I'm getting off on a different subject. So radiation crystallization is the last one we'll look at, and this is an interesting phenomenon. What happens here is this is now not a this is not depositing from the atmosphere. This is changing within the upper structure. In fact, it's the upper five millimeters, less than a centimeter of snow. And what happens, snow is, as I said, it's a black body, so snow is black. And we're all happy with that now, right? All on board with black snow. And it's also, but the ice itself is really transparent. I mean, if you take a good clear piece of ice and no bubbles in it, it's like glass. So the shortwave radiation, the solar radiation, penetrates that pretty well. The reason it's white is you got all these facets that are reflecting everything everywhere, and it looks white. But the snow can penetrate. It's very wavelength dependent. It's absorbed in the red. It goes very deep in the blue. And anyone scuba dive, as you do that, you'll notice if you cut yourself, it's green kind of thing. That's the same thing going on. Okay, snow is water. So anyway, so what's going on here? The shortwave radiation is penetrating, heating the subsurface. This graphic's a little bit more heating than it's going to actually do. But at the same time, it's losing due to that longwave radiation. And at the very surface, we get these massive temperature gradients within the top centimeter or so, a few centimeters, massive temperature gradients very, very quickly. And you know, hundreds of degrees per meter temperature gradients. And you end up with these, from the top, they look like a bunch of needles. And here's a little video of how we make these in the lab. So here's the box. This would be much like the box that we would have done the surface ore in, where a little cup would have been buried along the same plane as that surface. So we're just snowing on that. But this is snow but running through a sieve because we want it to be a strong. We want a strong layer. We want it well bonded. So this, think about this as being having saltated over the side of the mountain, deposited, and now we let it sit, and we're going to let it sinter. We make it hard. Then, once we got our surface, we run the ceiling temperature to minus 50. We run the room at minus 10, minus 5. And then we just hit it with that long wave, short wave imbalance and just let it do its thing. And we end up with that structure that you just saw there real quickly. Come back a little later, maybe a day later or a night later that night, and we sift another layer on top of that. We bury that little frame there. And we're going to use that to load that thing. And then we sift that in, we bury it, think a new windstorm just came in, buried this radiation crystallized layer, and now it's buried, so it's got a strong layer that we think should have gotten weakened as a result of this energy imbalance, and then we buried that, let that top layer become the nominal avalanche slab, and then we're going to take it and clear away the side, so we isolate it, we know all the area, we can see the side, and let's see. We're going to take it and cover the top, and then we're going to, with this actuator right there, we can load that. We can load it vertically, or we can load it horizontally or at some angle to simulate a slope angle, but we're just loading it horizontally in this test. So you see that little actuator moves back and forth. Then we take a stain, just some paint, we flick on the side, and by using, it's called particle imaging velocimetry. It's cool, huh? And what it does is it tracks these particles, and it's basically an optical strain gauge. You know, so it sees how things are going to develop. So now we take it and we load it, and this it's going to be exciting. Just watch it, watch it, watch it, watch it. It's happening. Watch it. Oh God, it happened. See? Did you see that? Was that not? So, want to see that again? Let's see that again. So that's failure, right? It doesn't look like that big of a deal, okay? But if you think about that being the weak spot, and that fails, and fracture propagates underneath the rest of that slab. Now we've got this. Now we have this situation, you know, magnified quite a bit, but we've got a hard layer with a good running surface. We've got this weak layer that developed within the layer. It wasn't deposited. That was a new layer that developed from that very strong layer. It lost about 80% of its strength, and so it became very, very weak. And I should have been pointing out what we were doing here, but the I'll go back just a little bit. Okay, so we take that, and after we do the speckling, we can post-process that. Yeah, so we post-process that, and you can see that layer in there starting to develop, and that's strain, that's displacement, if you like. And it's so we're looking at, you can see it build up, and there's our weak layer that we developed, very thin. I mean, we're talking half a centimeter, and pop, it goes. So that was that exciting failure that you saw, but that's the failure. So then we take that, we post-process it, we kind of look at it and measure strength and that sort of thing, okay? Anyway, just a few more quick pictures because they're just beautiful crystals that developed. A lot of these needle-type structures, and you can see how small that's, a millimeter grid. These are tiny little needles. And these are kind of that surface stuff. And needles. We also saw some. The first thing you notice are all the needles on top. But then we dug down a little bit. I mean, we're talking tiny here, but there's another little faceted crystal that grew in there. And what's interesting was to us at least, look at that chain that's growing. So we now have a structure in that top half a centimeter that's doing all these things, and there's at least two layers in there. So there's just a blow-up of that a little closer. But this is very cool, too. And maybe I'm hung up on the fact that we can grow crystals, want to pick up the crystallographic orientation of whatever the original parent structure is. But this is a little stellar dendrite, a snow crystal. And all the things, all these little champagne flutes that grew out of it all have the same crystallographic orientation. And these came out of the field. These weren't lab pictures. But I thought that was just very cool. They're just really pretty little things. So, and a few more pictures. And this radiation recrystallization, we did a similar thing. We just took a series of shots through here over time, and I'll take a look at that. And so there's our original structure. It was sintered, well, strong, bonded. Then we hit it with the radiation, and you can see after about 7 hours, we're starting to get these structures starting to develop in the top. And then in another 5 or 6 hours, look what's happened to that structure. That's why it's 80% weaker. You know, there's nothing left. It's mostly air. These fine little crystals up on the top, like I say, they're mostly what you notice, but these structures down below. So if you look at it from above, this is a shot from the top, you see all these crystals. And those first pictures at the end of the video, they were just the surface shots. That's what you're seeing. But we also have these chains and cups that are forming underneath it. And it turns out that the failure is happening kind of in this area, seems. And I'll take one more of that just because it's cool. So trying to look at these, this is the final, and we just pulled out one little piece and to emphasize what's going on here, that this whole new structure that's developed in this top half a centimeter is kind of emphasized right here. And you can see it's trying to push all that thermal energy through, and it gets to the top, and I have some ideas what's happening is it's pushing so much thermal energy, it gets to the top. I think that some of that, those little needles that are growing on top are actually coming out so fast they're redepositing from interior, and there's some sort of a cycle in there. But so, and then we were really surprised when we started seeing these little cups forming within this little layer. You know, it was really kind of remarkable. So that was... I like the video, so. Okay. Let it put itself back together. Okay, so what do we need for an avalanche? Well, it could be this weak layer that little hand is pointing on. It could be the depth ore. So there's a surface layer, there's a depth ore layer, there's whatever, there's a weak layer. Well, that weak layer, that surface ore, is not a problem until we throw some snow on top of it. So snows, it gets buried. Give that a little time to sint or throw a trigger on there, such as a skier, a snowmobile, or whatever. Put it on a slope, and those are the components for an avalanche, okay? So microstructure basically is everything, and this whole metamorphosis concept. And so this was like, this is where I'm going to wax poetic, okay? So it's supposed to be the metamorphosis of snow, so I said, well, it's the metamorphosis of me, you know, we're going through life cycle. How's that, okay? So all these changes have gone, and that's true. I've gone through quite a few. I guess the metamorphosis here is going to become a strong snow or a weak snow, a faceted snow, a multifaceted snow, a round snow. And I guess I came from an English major on Long Island to giving this lecture, okay? That's pretty wild, you know? How did that happen, I wonder? You know, it's like, was it talking heads? How did I get here? This is not my life, right? So the Japanese have a word, it's called furosato, and it means home village or home place. And it doesn't mean that's necessarily the village you came from, but it's sort of the one that you're at home. And there was early 19th century poet called Issa who walked around Japan spouting poetry, okay? And but he was in search, and he finally went back to his furosato, okay? So Issa's journey home, okay? And so I was thinking about that, trying to figure out how to close this. And so Issa, this is a haiku, and so it's a short poem, and that'll fit in, right? Forever this to be my home, 5 feet of snow. So my furosato, you know, it's this university has been a huge part of my life, this town, this whole region. It is my furosato. So, I mean, Michigan was great. Other places are great. I lived in Idaho for a little bit, too. I didn't cover that in this spiel. But this is home, you know. So I really feel fortunate to be here. And thank everyone for coming. This is really nice, you know, and I hope you enjoyed a little bit of it. Thank you.